Hello, I'm Michaela Maguire, Artistic Director of Melbourne Writers Festival. You're listening to a conversation from our 2021 podcast series, which is supported by the Copyright Agency's Cultural Fund.
Hello, my name is Elizabeth McCarthy. I'm a producer and presenter on Free Triple R FM in Melbourne, and I'm a literary critic and book reviewer on Triple R. It is a pleasure to be part of this podcast for the Melbourne Writers Festival. And I would like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land on which I'm located today. It is Wurundjeri land, and I pay my respects to elders past and present, and I extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples listening. Today I'm interviewing two authors for MWF, and let me tell you a bit about them. Alice Pung is an award-winning writer based in Melbourne. She is the best-selling author of the memoirs Unpolished Gem and Her Father's Daughter and the essay collection Close to Home, as well as the editor of the anthologies Growing Up Asian in Australia and My First Lesson. Her first novel, Lorinda, won the Ethel Turner Prize at the 2016 New South Wales Premier's Literary Awards. 100 Days is her most recent novel, and it's what we'll be talking about today. It explores the complex and fraught psychological ties between a mother and daughter, navigating domestic upheaval, abandonment issues, economic instability, shame, and societal pressures when teenage daughter Karuna falls pregnant. Hello, Alice. How are you going?
Oh, good, Elizabeth. How are you going?
Yeah, pretty good, thanks. And Emily Maguire is also on the panel today. She is the author of six novels, including the Stella Prize and Miles Franklin Award shortlisted An Isolated Incident, and three nonfiction books. Her articles and essays on sex, feminism, culture, and literature have been published widely, including in the Sydney Morning Herald, The Australian, The Observer, and The Age. Emily works as a teacher and as a mentor to young and emerging writers, and was the 2018-19 Writer in Residence at the Charles Perkins Centre at the University of Sydney. Her new novel, Love Objects, explores the complex dynamics of a family grappling with multi-generational upheaval, intergenerational trauma and shame, and what it means to try to fill up emotional longings with distraction, avoidance, and lots of consumer goods. Hello, Emily.
Hello.
Hello. So let me get started with some questions for you both. So one of the striking things about both of these novels is how determined and strong-willed your characters are, even when they're facing seemingly insurmountable odds. So these characters are resourceful, indefatigable, and full of chutzpah. Could you each please talk about the characters in these recent books that you have each personally felt most attached to and why? Start with you, Alice.
Oh, sure. So my main character, Karuna, as you mentioned, Elizabeth, is a 16-year-old girl who falls pregnant. I think I'm most attached to her because I grew up about a decade after the book set. The book set in 1987, and it's deliberately set then because there was no internet then, so there was no way she could find out what her options were. So she lives in the 14th floor of a housing commission flat. Again, it's a very familiar setting with me because half of my family lived in those flats. So I know it really well, and I really identify with her only because there's a tendency for young adult books written by adults to really give the female characters all these traits. And all these traits are quirks. They're feisty, they're independent, they're sassy, they have a retort, you know, they're sarcastic. So basically the pregnant teenager is often presented as the Juno character. You know that movie Juno where she's pregnant? Yep. And it's quite delightful. I wanted to portray a realistic pregnant teenager who talks like a real teenager. She doesn't say very much. And when she does, she's complaining about her mother or yelling at her mother. So that's the way I was as a teenager. It wasn't very pleasant. I had bit long periods of, you know, feeling depressed, feeling trapped. And yet I wanted to give her an interior life that was accurate, because teenagers are reading Shakespeare and Charles Dickens, and the teenagers I grew up with had very adult responsibilities. They were either taking care of sick parents or younger siblings, or they came as unaccompanied minors. So they were basically adults by the age of 14. And that's what I wanted to portray with Karuna. She's still a child, but she's also very adult, more so than most of her peers at school, which is why she doesn't go to school. She just can't relate to anyone there.
Fascinating. And how about you, Emily? Could you talk about the characters that you felt most enamored of and attached to when you were writing Love Objects?
Yeah, it's a really hard question because I have three main characters and I sort of move between them. And one of the things about writing the book that was most difficult was I would get too overly connected with any one of them. And then because they're in conflict with each other, I'd come to write another point of view and feel really angry with that character. But I'll talk about the character that the novel started with, I guess, which is Nick. She's a middle-aged, kind of street-smart sort of woman without much formal education. She's lifelong, proud checkout chick. She lives alone. She's sort of a fairy godmother to the neighbourhood's cats, much to the disgust of her neighbours in the sort of rapidly gentrifying area that she's living in, attracting all these stray cats all the time to walk all over their cars. And she lives a pretty self-sufficient and happy life until the day, you know, very early on in the novel when her stuff, which turns out is an awful lot of stuff in her home. It's the kind of home other people would call a hoarder's home, but she would never identify in that way. She has an accident and her stuff almost kills her. And this is the moment that sort of brings interference into her situation, mostly in the form of her niece, Lena, who had really looked up to and admired her auntie and seen her as someone who's sort of her example of, you know, instead of what would Jesus do, it would be what would Auntie Nick do when she's in difficult situations. But Lena hasn't been inside her auntie's house for a long time and hasn't realised how she was living. So I guess one of the things I was interested in terms of that character as well is how well we know people and how someone can be living in a way that you actually know nothing about, even if you see them a lot and speak to them a lot. And that was something in that relationship of those two women of maybe the line between privacy and secrecy in their lives and the line in when do you interfere with someone's life or when is it just helping? How do you help someone who doesn't want to be helped or doesn't think they need help? And so I think this thing switches in terms of a character that I related to and felt admirable. There's so many things about Nick that I really love and that she's sort of really writing from a really deep part of myself, actually, and the women in my family. But there's also a real loneliness in her. That she's managed to keep a lot of people away. And that was part of why, you know, switching back and forth between the points of view in that, thinking what's stopping these people who really love and care about each other from actually fully connecting.
The both of these novels are fraught with family tensions and resentments and sort of navigating boundaries where and overstepping boundaries and support, you know, these are families that you've both written about that are at in turn supporting each other but also interfering with each other. And I'm hoping that you could talk about what you each wanted to grapple with about family dynamics in these novels. Alice, could you start off for us?
Oh, sure. So I have three children now. You know, I wrote 100 Days when I was a parent of one child and finished it when I was pregnant with my third. So it's a book about, you know, when you have a child, you have absolute control over them as a baby, and that should be right because you've got to look after them. They can't make any decisions on their own. But then I think what happens if your mode of responding to your child is completely reactive because your life is so crammed with stress and tension, as with a lot of the immigrant women with whom I grew up. So their way of parenting their children was completely reactive in that I've seen some of my son's friends sit them down and explain to them the dangers of running into traffic, you know, politely and kindly, and we love you, we don't want you to get hurt. Whereas if we ever did it when we were kids, my mum would just grab us by the seat of our pants, give us a smack and say, "You're trying to get yourself killed. Why do you cause me such mischief?" You know, and so through the lens of a middle-class parent as I am now, that sounds kind of abusive if the mother also throws in a few profanities. And I've seen it in supermarkets where I live. I saw a mother yelling at her child and using sort of colourful language that I was very used to growing up, except no one could understand us because it was in a different language, except this mother was using English. And this lady stopped and said, "Excuse me. How dare you use that language of your child? That's abuse. Do you know that's abuse?" And I was conflicted. I stood there and I thought, oh, good on that lady. She's defending that child. And then I thought, well, does that mean that my parents who love me and who invested everything they had into me were abusive. So it's, you know, I don't think so, but a lot of people who have read this book have said there is no love in this book. This is a very abusive, codependent relationship. And I wonder how much of it's cultural and how much of it is class-based, this judgment. So that's what I wanted to explore in 100 Days.
Yeah, you do that so well. And you also explore about what it means to stay in a really fraught family relationship and whether to sort of, you know, whether you can actually get away. Emily, could you speak to that as well, about the family dynamics that you wanted to grapple with in Love Objects?
Yeah, so I think the central sort of love story, family love story in Love Objects is an auntie for her niece and nephew. And that is, you know, also something really personal to me and something I've written about in nonfiction but never in a novel before. This huge thing in my life. So I don't have kids, and yet I now, well, before COVID anyway, I had a life where pretty much every weekend and a lot of weekdays too is my schedule works around children, because between myself and my partner, we have what often feels like hundreds, but it's actually 17 nieces and nephews. And so I have a life that is so filled with children, and they're so important to me, and I just can't imagine who I would be without them actually now. And yet that's not a choice I ever made. You know, that's just the blessing of other people having lots of kids. And so there's something I really wanted to explore, though, is that, you know, Nick, the character in the novel, she feels that way about her niece and nephew, her sister's kids. You know, the backstory of the novel is that her sister at one stage just moves away to another state, and the kids are suddenly gone from Nick's life. And there's not sort of divorce proceedings to get, you know, custody or to have visitation rights to someone else's kids, and you actually have no right to someone else's kids, as you shouldn't. Rights is the wrong language to use. But what is the language to use around these hugely important relationships that we can have with children or with just people in an extended family, that especially in, you know, this sort of really Western culture, this idea of the nuclear family and the importance of that unit, and when that doesn't work, which it doesn't for these characters in my novel mostly, you know, what are those bonds, and is there any way to hold on to them except for sheer bloody mindedness sometimes? And then other people will, you know, like that woman in the market, Alice, be like, that's inappropriate to intervene, or it's the right thing to do, intervene. Like, how do you intervene in how someone else is raising their kids? And does it matter if they're some way related to you or not? And all these kind of questions I just found really interesting. And then because of the situation in the novel, that it's the auntie, it's the middle-aged woman who has this accident, suddenly it's her 20-year-old niece and then early 20s nephew who are sort of performing this role that we would expect maybe young adults to perform for their parents in caring for them and taking responsibility, but not have that same sense of, like, no one is actually going to judge Lena, for example, who's 20 and at university, if she doesn't drop everything to take care of her auntie. So she's doing that for different reasons other than there's just some societal kind of burden on her. And I was interested in that too.
One thing about the female characters in both of your novels, there are so many similarities between these novels thematically. You've each created central female characters who experience enormous shame because of their sexual choices. In your novel, Emily, Lena is humiliated via an online porn site. The footage of her engaging in sex with someone is distributed widely. And in your novel, Alice, the character Karuna is 16 years old and pregnant. There's enormous shame culturally with that. So what I was thinking about too was how there's this indulgent contemporary idea that it was far worse in the past for girls and women being shamed for sex than it is now. But these two novels really illuminate what sexual shame looks like in a contemporary sense. Could you each speak to that, please, about, you know, writing these stories of the emotional and psychological consequences of sexual shame in the present day, even though, as you flagged, Alice, your novel is set 30 years ago, that still very much is the present day in a greater context.
Yeah, that's true, Elizabeth. And when I read Emily's book, it's so nuanced because, you know, Lena goes back to that asshole who made a video of her. She can't help herself, and you don't judge her for that because he's quite conniving and quite charming. And yet society does judge young women for their sheer stupidity. And that's exactly what happens to my character as well. And it's based on what I've seen of some of my friends. And this was back in the late 80s and early 90s, where I didn't see them. They got pregnant and they disappeared off the face of the earth. And that's because their parents were embarrassed and said, look, you can keep the baby, but the baby has to be your sister. So two things happen there. The girl can go back to school or get a job, or she can continue on with her life. And the other thing is that no one needs to know that she was a teenage mum. And some of these friends who I saw later in life just ended up out working or working in factories. So it can change your life, but no one really makes the young man pay the consequences, hey? Or even sometimes looks for the young man.
Yeah, absolutely. But I mean, both the men who are involved with these women in each of your novels get away with a hell of a lot. Emily, could you speak to that as well, about the sexual shame that you're exploring with the character Lena in your novel?
Yeah, I'd love to. I just want to say too, though, in Alice's book, I think I must be pretty much exactly the same age as Karuna if we were in present day. And all the references hit me very hard. And I think I've said in an email to Alice the labyrinth moment of sexual awakening. David Bowie in Labyrinth, you know, very close to home. But what I loved about Karuna's sort of sexuality and the way it's portrayed is, even though there is this enormous shame because she does become pregnant, the experience for it herself is so sort of private and beautiful in that way. It's like she's just really finding something for herself and expressing it. And it's not really about that particular bloke or
anyone else or any of those messages. It's not about having a group of friends to tell.
It's just this kind of beautiful privacy of her discovering something for herself that I really loved that about it. With Lena, something that I sort of grappled with a bit was how to show that there was a real difference, and this is very contemporary, and this is from talking to a lot of young women who I know now. There is a big difference between shame of sex itself and wanting it, and this kind of shame that is put on women for being stupid about it or for asking for it, whatever people think they might be asking for. And so I actually took a lot of care, not that it wasn't fun, but I took a lot of care to make the sex scene between Lena and this guy really explicit, to show that she's having a really good time. She is not being exploited in terms of that actual encounter. That does, you know, it's a much overused word, empowerment, in terms of these things, but she is quite empowered in the sex itself and has a really great time. And so it's not that actually brings any shame on her. Mm. It's the fact that somehow she was meant to know better than to let herself be filmed, which was something she didn't know was happening. But there's immediately, it's not, no one's actually saying to her or even suggesting you shouldn't be having good sex, because that is actually part of being a young woman, at least within her sort of social set. It's how could you let this happen, that now you're this thing that people can watch doing this in all your shame. And it was really important to me, I guess, to show that difference, that it's actually a really difficult thing to deal with as a young woman if you take in all those messages from both sides. Because actually, what are you supposed to do? Like, you can get carried away and be really attracted to someone and be really into it and be having a great time, which is good. And then at the same time, are you meant to treat, you know, any boy or man that you might have this attraction to as a suspicious force and check the premises for, you know, like it's, you can't, that's not how it works. And so this bind, and again, like you said, Elizabeth, the guy's kind of getting off scot-free in a way, of the shame isn't really on him for doing this incredibly violating thing to someone without their consent. The shame is on her for, you know, quote-unquote letting it happen.
Well, if anything, he's sort of seen as a little bit industrious for, you know, setting up.
He did a good job setting up
cameras, etc. Another sort of theme that these novels have in common, and indeed you as writers have in common, I think, is that you write about characters who face economic uncertainty and job insecurity. And it's always struck me as remarkable how, and the older I get, it just seems even more amplified, how little fiction there is featuring characters with money problems. broadly. And refreshingly, you both centralise socioeconomic inequalities in the stories that you write. Could you speak about that? I mean, is that, does that sort of come with the characters that you want to write about? Or is it actually something that you feel is really important to centralise in your stories? Could you start for us, Emily?
Both of those things are true. It does just come with the characters that I'm writing. It's part of their lives, and they are people who I know. But it's also important to me, I guess, politically, although I definitely don't think that way when I'm setting out to start the novel, but it's sort of, I suppose, part of my worldview that makes its way into the novel. There's this quote from the American writer Grace Paley that I really return to and love, even though I'm going to get it a little bit wrong now. But she said something like, you know, you can write about anything you want, but for the story to be interesting to her, and she's implying to anyone, it should have the facts of blood and money. And by that, she means family and economic circumstances. Mm-hmm. Like, and I think about it a lot because I do read novels that, I mean, I enjoy, I love, I see the artistry, I see the craft, I see the universal humanity and all those kind of things we're looking for. But I also feel a bit like it's like watching a film and it's still got the green screen and that hasn't added in all the effects of the world. It just feels quite removed from life. And, you know, I do wonder, these, however interesting or important or profound the problems the characters are facing and all that, I'm like, how are you paying for any of this? How are you getting money? Like, is it the day that your government benefit's coming in? Is it dole day? Is it payday? Did you have overtime this week and that's why you can have this extra big night out, this bender that causes all this trouble for the characters? You know, who's picking up the kids? Where are the kids? Like, all this kind of stuff. And it doesn't have to be what it's about, but I do feel there's this lack of veracity or realness when I read things, and that stuff is just sort of not there. It feels artificial.
Mm. I mean, it also strikes me often when, particularly watching cinema, I guess, but also in novels, where characters don't even appear to have to go to work very much at all. Alice, your novel 100 Days, like, these are real working people, and part of your novel is actually set in a salon where the mother works and the daughter actually ends up working for free, or, you know, for money that her mother's away. Could you talk about this kind of socioeconomic world that your characters inhabit?
Oh, sure. So like Emily, it's a very real world. In order to live, my characters and the people around me in life have to sell their time, you know, on an hourly by hourly basis. And if they don't sell their time, they don't live. I love that Grace Paley quote, Emily, and it reminds me of a quote by another author named Anne Boyer. She said, "I sometimes imagine some alien reader picking up a contemporary novel and thinking that everything about our species in our time and place was feelings of self-identification, self-interest, self-fulfillment, self-determination." It's, you know, all these feelings floating in space, whereas the characters that Emily and I write about, their feelings are almost reactions to their circumstances or to what happens to them in life. They don't emerge out of nowhere. You know, they feel certain things because their tooth aches and they can't see a dentist. They feel certain things because their mothers made them work as a cheap laborer in this, you know, hairdressing salon. Or they feel certain things because they've had sex in the back of a car and now they don't know what to do because they're pregnant. It's direct. There's a direct consequence that these feelings come from.
And these feelings and these circumstances all intersect with the ways in which these characters inhabit the world and the external world. So I'm curious about, because there's quite a contrast between these novels. They are about working class people, working people. And I'm curious about the external scopes of these novels, because, Alice, the world of your novel is very claustrophobic with the domestic intensity between Karuna and her mother. And the outside world, or the bigger world, is almost like an abstract concept in many ways, because the claustrophobia of this relationship and this world in which they inhabit is so sort of close. While Emily, your characters are actually probably moving about more freely in the world than Alice's characters are. They're more freely participating in the world, even though it's an often very unkind world that they encounter. So could you each talk about the extent to which you wanted your characters to inhabit and feel connected to the wider world? Because there's a contrast going on between these novels.
Sure, Elizabeth. So for a lot of immigrant women, and for some in my family, unfortunately, they don't have much to do with the outer world, depending on the levels of chauvinism in the family, you there's one auntie I have who doesn't go to the supermarket and hasn't been ever since she came here about 45 years ago. Her husband does everything, and she's not disabled or anything like that. So her world is really small, and she doesn't speak English, and she can't read a newspaper or watch television and understand anything. And when I was growing up, being a minor, and this is so interesting, you know, when you're 18, you can go anywhere. And then when you're 17 and 16, you're under the rule of your parents. So my world was pretty circumscribed as well. Not to mention, we grew up in a bit of a rough neighborhood. So I thought my parents were overly paranoid, but you know, there were circumstances where sometimes I'd walk home from school and cars would yell out obscenities and things. So it was actually not a pleasant place to be out in the inner suburbs of Braybrook. So the world is circumscribed just because the people have limited language, limited finances, and limited movement. Like the women's movement for my characters is not this ideology, it's literal. It's the ability for this woman to move. Yeah,
absolutely. How about you, Emily? Could you talk about the how your characters participate in the wider world, and why you made the choices that you have with respect to that?
Yeah, so I'm so interested in this question and how relative it all is too. So for Nick, she's got a job that she's had for years. She goes out into the world every day. She works behind a counter. But to her, the world is her home, and she is, you know, someone who has invested so much emotional energy and love into her objects, into her stuff, the stuff that when she has this accident, other people consider as garbage that needs to be taken away. And so the character of Nick, she sort of doesn't go anywhere at all during this novel apart from home and the hospital. She's not moving around in that sense. But until all her objects that she's sort of curated to have around her, until that's taken away, she doesn't feel, I don't think, in any way constrained or that she's missing out. She can be at home, and everything that's around her is kind of stories upon stories and memories, and putting her back in touch with every important moment she's ever had. And so she really, you know, she wouldn't use this language, but I think she feels like the world is right there with her. And the taking that away is what makes her feel isolated. Whereas for many other people, being in her home with all the stuff in it would be the very definition of being trapped and claustrophobic. And I think that's such a big thing for me, to just really live this value of understanding that people don't see the world in the same way, and that what looks so claustrophobic and trapping to someone else is actually luxurious and safe for her. The other thing that I think is interesting is that Lena is the first of her family to go to university, and it's something she has fought really hard for. She had to do sort of an extra TAFE course after she finished high school because she didn't get the marks for it. So she's a bit older than some of her peers. And to her, it's this huge, huge deal that she's actually moved states from Queensland to get to Sydney and to get to university. But she's surrounded by people who, it's nothing, like they've all had gap years and been to Europe and been all over, and it's a really part of their ordinary lives to quite literally travel the world. And so even though Lena, to her, within her family, has done something massive and amazing, once she's in this context at university, she feels really small and unworldly. And so that thing of relativity in terms of how we think of what our world should be and how other people influence in thinking what it should be, I think is something that I'm really interested in there. And you know, something that I think many of us have been having these conversations over the last 18 months, who have become used to thinking of ourselves as, oh, I'm a world traveller, I go wherever I like. And so, like, don't worry, if that was your personality before, because maybe you thought it was something else.
That's true.
Emily, you were granted a Judy Harris Writer in Residence Fellowship at the University of Sydney's Charles Perkins Centre, which assisted in writing this book. Could you talk about how that informed and influenced what you wrote, and, you know, the benefits of that fellowship?
Yeah, it's amazing. I believe it's unique, this fellowship that is at the Charles Perkins Centre at Sydney Uni, which is a centre dedicated to not just medical research, but quite specifically, I guess, what's sometimes called lifestyle disease. So the kind of things that people might say we give ourselves. So obesity, smoking-related diseases, things where they're not contagious. It's something in how we're living. And this seems like an odd fit for a novelist to be in there, but this incredible fellowship has deliberately taken this view to put a creative writer in there every year, along with the other interdisciplinary scientists and academics and researchers, to actually have real conversations around how to apply the medical research and medicine to people's actual lives, and why the reason sometimes why you can have all the best information in the world and people still aren't taking that medical advice, and it's because they're living lives. And so it was extraordinary to be part of that. In terms of this novel, I had the opportunity to research hoarding on this really deep level. There's a lot of connections there with a couple of the major hospitals in Sydney as well, and to get to know people who are really working on the front lines of this condition and people who are experiencing it as well and who have hoarding behaviour. Not to write a self-help book about hoarding, but just to really make sure that it's such a complicated behaviour and the ways it's treated are so complicated too. And so I was able to sort of do that really in-depth research to make sure I was getting it as right as possible. And also that thing too, that larger idea about, just like with smoking, we can have all the information in the world about what it's going to do to you and how bad it is, and yet people still choose to do it. And that is immensely frustrating to the medical researchers and to doctors and to public health officials, and often to family members and loved ones who are just like, why do you keep doing this thing? And that is something that comes up a lot with hoarding behavior as well. I found that a lot of the people who exhibit hoarding behavior, not always, but many of them, like Nick, are really happy and they are not suffering through this behaviour. And although it can be very dangerous, and I don't want to romanticise that, because there are some really serious accidents and conditions and fires and things like that, so it's legitimate that loved ones would be really worried, that there is this tension between how much do you interfere in something and take away someone's actual pleasure and their life. Like what are we saving people for, I suppose, is often what comes into it. And again, a lot of conversations in these COVID times have touched on quite similar things, like at what expense physical health, what expense mental health to ensure physical health. And there just are no easy answers. And I think public health policy and how we treat our closest loved ones is often this balance between how much do we intervene to insist upon someone doing something for their health, and how that can actually interfere with their whole sense of themselves in the world.
Absolutely. Alice, could you talk about research that you have undertaken for any of your novels?
As Emily said, you know, how much do we intervene for the sake of someone's health? And when you are a parent, you you know, you almost have absolute control over that child's health until they're 18. And it's fine if you are a parent who we would regard as reasonable. But what happens if that parent is not very well educated, is illiterate, is of a very different cultural background, and very superstitious, which is what I wanted to explore in 100 days, because there's this idea of after a mother gives birth to a baby, in many cultures, not just Asian, Southeast Asian, Greek cultures, there's a period of confinement where the mother is meant to rest for 30 to 100 days, depending on what culture they're from. And other people are meant to do things for them. So either their mother or mother-in-law will do all the housework, only bring them the baby to be nursed, and then take the baby away so the mother can rest. And this is because about 1,000 years ago, if you gave birth, you weren't allowed to go outside because you'd get an airborne illness. You weren't meant to drink cold water from the well because there'd be waterborne diseases. So all these things were meant to protect the health of the mother. And sometimes you'd be bathed in very special herbs so that it would warm your skin. So all these things have a scientific basis in traditional Chinese medicine, because I talked to these practitioners who were in Sydney, actually, Emily, and they do a wonderful thing. So they send herbs to Asian mothers who don't have their mothers or mother-in-laws in Australia. So every week they'll send a batch of herbs for you to boil up and serve to your wife or your, you know, sister to help her recuperate. Now, what happens if your parents or your family members aren't that educated? So I'll give you a real life example. This is what happens. You know, three generations. When my grandparents were alive and my son was born, my parents, my mum took her new grandson, so proud of him, to her mother and said, "Look, I'm a grandma." And my grandmother, who was my son's great grandmother, was really pleased. And she said to my mum, "Listen, you've got to go to the Chinese grocery store and you've got to buy the most expensive bottle of rice wine, and you've got to give her a big cup every evening after dinner." And my mother just looked at her mother with absolute scorn and said, "Mom, we don't do these peasant things anymore in Australia. We don't do stuff like that, you know." And I thought, wow, that's exactly how I am with my mother when she told me not to read at night because I'll go blind because I just had a baby. I'm like, Mom, we don't do these things anymore. So it's generational, just the psychological aspect of it, the contempt you have for your own mother, which doesn't transcend to your auntie or your grandparents, because you're like, oh, that's my auntie, that's my grandma, she means well, you know. But also the physical, the health side of things, where if you have no sense of autonomy as a 15-year-old, you have to drink that wine. You have to take those whatever weird crap they give you. I'm not disparaging traditional Chinese medicine, but some, you know, some cultural practices which aren't scientifically based are just as bad as what Donald Trump tells people to take for coronavirus. So, you know, yeah, and could damage you.
We've actually, I think we've run out of time, but I wanted to thank you both so much for speaking to me today and congratulations on these novels. I've been speaking to Alice Pung about 100 Days and Emily Maguire about her novel Love Objects. If you see these in your local bookshop, these two novels, you won't be able to miss them. The covers are absolutely extraordinary and apparently they're done by the same artist. I believe it's Sandy Cull, is that correct?
Who's
done the covers for both of these stunning novels. Thank you so much and thanks to Melbourne Writers Festival for hosting this conversation.
Thanks for listening. To support Melbourne Writers Festival, you can make a donation of any size at mwf.com.au.